Gotta love working from home and like a brew and a penguin in the afternoon, like that's true.
Well, I've got some chunky Kit Kats, and they're those, you know, those multi packs where they're sort of
like an inch big.
Well, two thirds of the size of a normal one, and it just leaves you a little bit underwhelmed, doesn't it?
You not just have two like I do.
Yeah, but then that's the equivalent of 1.5 chunky Kit Kats.
I'm still failing to see the floor, to be honest.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
So, 15 wins in a row and a new English record for Pep Guardiola to cap off a week where Manchester City went to Anfield and scored four. Everything's going to plan this season, and City have put themselves in a commanding position in the Premier League and through to the quarterfinals of the FA Cup. And not only did City win at Liverpool for the first time in nearly 18 years, but they did it after missing a penalty and after the setback of Ruben Dias's first mistake since his arrival. Mentality monsters or what? We'll be reviewing those two games on this week's show, plus looking ahead to the next two as Spurs and Everton appear over the horizon. And an already tough run gets a little bit tougher. We'll be hearing from former City and Everton fullback Michael Ball, plus Howard Hocking is discussing Phil Foden, so let's crack on. I'm David Mooney, with me this week is Goal.com's Jonathan Smith.
Hello.
And City fan and former Blue Moon podcast host until he buggered off to London for his new job, Sam Roscoe.
You've got to let it go, that was 2 years ago.
I know, mate, I know, but you know, like, we had you on after the Lyon debacle last year, and I said to you after that show, we need to get you back when it's a good week, and I thought, what better week than when City have won at Anfield for the first time in nearly two decades, you know? So Sam, starting off with that game, looking at the title picture now, 5 points clear of second place, City still got a game in hand. It's City's title to lose, is it?
I think when you look at the form of other teams as well, you take that into consideration and this monster run that that City are on. You know, there are a lot of similarities, aren't there, with this monster run to when they previously won the title. And you need that consistency in any Premier League title race. And City are currently the team that have it. It looks... it's difficult to see a side stopping them. So I think certainly it is City's title to lose. The only thing that concerns me is maybe, you know, if they throw it away, if they have some injuries, if Ruben Dias gets injured. But it's not looking like that's going to be happening at the minute. I know we're going to come on to, you know, the win at Anfield, but I just think in any other season, the circumstances in that game, you know, we would have capitulated. So I think you were right to say mentality monsters. I think they certainly are. And, you know, looking at the other sides, just don't know who's going to beat them, especially when they have that mentality of win at all costs, onto the next game, win at all costs, onto the next game. It's relentless at the minute.
Yeah, John, the thing is, like I said in the introduction there, not only are City 5 points clear of second place with a game in hand, it's not even a case now of who beats City, because even if City drop points, who's putting a run together that gets them ahead of City?
Yeah, I mean, I would add a slight note of caution. You know, it's not impossible for them to win two games on the trot. You know, they've got two very difficult games coming up this week, Spurs and Everton. Everton away, you know, those are hard games. A red card or something like that, and they lose two games. United win both their games, and suddenly, it's not quite as comfortable as it was. I mean, that's just a note of caution, because obviously, at the moment, City are looking unstoppable, and when you look at the rivals, you know, Liverpool look like they've got a lot of problems. Solskjaer has said that United aren't even title candidates. So, who else is there? Leicester, Chelsea are way off, and things like that. So, it is looking very comfortable. But like I say, a couple of defeats, then this packed schedule. Obviously, they've had to have two games now rearranged for midweek because of Carabao Cup and what's the other one they've got? The FA Cup quarter final. This Everton game is one that's been rearranged. So it's not done yet.
Well, we'll get into the game at Anfield again in a minute, Sam. But like, have a listen to this. This is like, if all the games are played now on the three midweeks, if the games to be rearranged are put on the three midweeks, this is City's schedule. Okay, from now until the end of the season, so the middle of May, they get 4 days break, then 4 days break, 3 days, 3 days, 3 days, 4 days, 3 days, 4 days, 3 days, 4 days. Then there's 14 days, which is an international break, so there's probably going to be two games for most of the players in there to jet off around the world to at some point. Then after that, they've got a run again. 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. 2 days, 3 days, 5 days. 4 days, 2 days. 5 days, 2 days. 4 days, 3 days. 4 days, 4 days. And then they'll get a massive 6 day break to the Champions League final if they get there. Like, how on earth how do they cope with that?
Yeah, I get your point. And I think, you know, what you've just said there, it just shows how important this run that they're currently on has been, because the season is going to cut. You know, it is absolutely chocker with fixtures, and the fact that they are being so consistent now, when you compare it to other teams who are in a similar position, fighting on a number of fronts when it comes to the trophies, no one is anywhere near Manchester City for consistency at the minute. And I think that's a massive plus. You know, look, I think it'd be unbelievable if they managed to continue on this winning run, you know, with the amount of games that are coming up. So City are going to drop points, but again, it's consistency factor, and the other teams, can I see any of them going on a 15-game run? Not at the minute. But yeah, you know, there are a lot of games coming up, and I think what we've learnt so far from the season is that Pep has really utilised his squad well, without disturbing it too much, if that makes sense. So where he has tweaked, he's not made massive changes. You know, we've seen John Stones play a lot of games, but at the same time, he'll be getting a rest every now and then as well.
Yeah.
And I think he's been really clever with that, the way he's tweaked the side, but he's made sure it's still a strong enough side to get the result. And I think that's all also down to the nature of City's squad. You know, it's very, very strong. And that's the reason why, you know, they have a strong squad to fight on all four fronts. But yeah, of course, no one's expecting like this incredible run of games every 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, etc.
Yeah, John, it's the one thing that we haven't addressed there in all of that as well is that there is literally now no more room in the schedule. So if anything gets postponed, they're going to have to play two games in a game week. They're going to have to play two games in a week.
Yeah. Yeah, and all it would take is a COVID outbreak at another club or something like that, and that would put them back. So it's very, very tough. And City have got to be careful with their injuries. They've got a big squad and got a couple of injuries at the moment. Well, obviously Sergio and Kevin have been out for a while, but we're waiting to hear what Rodri was like after he limped off against Swansea. Fernandinho didn't make the trip, so you know it only takes a couple of. I mean, I'm sounding very doom and gloom about this.
I'm the opposite way around, to be honest. I'm feeling pretty optimistic. Someone pinch me.
I was going to say, John, that they are 5 points clear of second place with the game in hand.
I am hugely optimistic, but I just think, I mean, it was Pep sort of was saying, well, we've won the title already, sarcastically, before the Swansea game. And I think he's got a point. It's not won. And for all the other sides that are out of form, you know, it doesn't take as much as I think some people think for it to change around. So if they keep this going for, you know, they've got this difficult run of games now where they've got top half sides coming up, Spurs, Everton, West Ham, Arsenal, the Derby. So if they get through that, still in the same position, I mean, you'd actually wouldn't bet against them being in a stronger position. But if they get through those games, 8 points clear, having played that game in hand, then you think, you know, that's almost over the, you know, as close to the finishing line as you get before crossing it.
The line's in sight, isn't it, at that point? Yeah. Let's talk about the tactics in Anfield, because I thought it was a fascinating game, John. The first half, not great. And Guardiola switched to 4-4-2, and suddenly they just took complete control of the game.
Yeah, I mean, first off, the lineup was there were a couple of surprises in there. I mean, obviously Foden's not necessarily played in these big games before, so it was a big sort of confidence boost to him to see him start and just shows exactly how far he's come now. But also Zinchenko playing at left back up against Mohamed Salah. I mean, what an impact Zinchenko is continuing to have. You know, he's been written off many times, and that was a big game against Liverpool's biggest threat. You know, one on one. Actually Zinchenko didn't really have a problem. It was slight. It was a mistake from Diaz for the goal, for the penalty. And also, it was a sharp bit of acting from Salah to miss the referee. So I thought it was a big game for him. So from that point of view, the tactics were absolutely spot on. I mean, I wasn't at the game, and I thought I was listening to Gary Neville on the commentary. I thought he was very pessimistic about both sides. You know, both sides are capable of picking off the others if you make errors. And I thought City were in control. There was a couple of chances in the first half. Mane had that header, which maybe he could have done better with. But I thought generally City were keeping them at bay. Didn't create too much. But yeah, it was interesting that switch to two false nines? I don't know.
Yeah, though, well, they were two kind of nominally centre forwards, but not centre forwards, were they? That was like fascinating. Sam, the first half, when you go back to half time in that game and you're thinking, right, we're going in at 0-0, we've missed a bloody penalty and the opportunity to take the lead in a game that we never take the lead in. Like, honestly, were you starting to fear the worst at that point, thinking even whatever happens, it's just going to be one of them days?
Well, it was just a case of here we go again, I think, wasn't it? You know, I think as well, so much was made of City's record at Anfield.
Partly by me, to be fair.
Yeah, David, you couldn't have mentioned it any more. I think, what was it, 6 Star Wars films or something like that they haven't won since then?
Yeah, I can confirm this week that there have been no Star Wars films released since City's last win at Anfield.
Yeah. Which is great. I'm really pleased to hear that.
How many Fast and Furious is?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't bother counting them because I don't think numbers go that high, do they? I don't know.
I think, look, you know, going into it at half time, it was a little bit not frustrating, because I think, you know, the first half, like John said, both teams were there to sort of pick each other off, and it was more frustrating that we had the opportunity, and it reminded me of when Mahrez missed the penalty, and that was obviously in the front of my mind at half time, thinking, yeah, we've been here before, you know, the remembering how it, you know, how things could have been, etc. But I was really impressed with the way he tweaked it into the second half, and the way City took the game to Liverpool, which we were kind of asking for, really, in the first half. I certainly was. I was thinking, you know, look, these are here to be taken, and I think if City kick it up a gear, they can really do some damage. And it really pleasing to see Pep make that positive change and really get the win. And again, just be ruthless. I get so much satisfaction out of seeing City be ruthless and almost arrogant in a way. It's an elite mentality, which I know I've banged on about this in the podcast for so many times in the past, but that's what we need. We're an elite team. We don't play at Main Road anymore. We don't have Sun Jai bombing down the wing.
We're not happy to just be in the conversation anymore. Yeah,
exactly. We should be going to Anfield, and we should be tearing them apart when they're in dire. When they hadn't even scored a goal at Anfield this year, we should be tearing them apart. So it was really pleasing to see that positive change, and it was really pleasing to see that ruthless side as well in the second half.
The ruthless thing, John, is it was fascinating the way City got the ball back off Liverpool. I don't normally do tactical analysis, but I posted a Twitter thread on this because I watched as City players didn't press the Liverpool defenders in the same way that they normally do. They would normally like surround the opposition and try and just force them to give them the ball back under pressure. But they recognised that players like Alisson or Alexander-Arnold would be happy to take that pressure and kind of play past it. So they just they pressed them in the way that just said, right, you're going to have no options when you've got the ball, and you can have a little bit more time, but just nobody to pass it to. And that was the big thing with the Alisson mistakes, like they've been called unforced errors, and they're not. They were very forced, weren't they?
Well, I think that one of the things they've been doing very, very effectively this season is these sort of setting traps where you give a player, you know, a DM, a little half a room, and then almost force the goalkeeper to play that pass, and then you press that person instantly, put them right under pressure. I think it was more particularly you saw it against the third goal against Swansea, where that just give them a little bit of room where they think they've got time and they actually haven't, and you're all over them. But also, I think, you know, this side is full of those players who, like Jesus when he came on, like Foden, like Bernardo, who it's just relentless, just charging all over the pitch at 100 miles an hour, harassing, hassling, just giving you no time at all. And I mean, it was there were mistakes from Alisson, there were poor clearances, but I agree there were forced errors as well.
Yeah. The funny thing is, though, Sam, when you look at all of this, we're talking about the performances of those front players, Foden, Sterling, Bernardo, for instance, and yet it was, again, mentality monster. It was Ilkay Gundogan. He's missed a penalty, and there he is, popped up twice with two great finishes and in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I need to come out publicly here and say I apologise to Ilkay Gundogan, because I've said a few things in the past that make me look like an idiot now. And I'm really pleased. I'm delighted to see that Gundogan is being the player that we all hoped he'd be. You know, I know he didn't have the easiest start to his career at Manchester City with that injury. But then it makes me think, you know, looking at Gundogan now, have we been playing him in the wrong position all the time? Have we been holding him back? Has Pep been holding him back? You know what? Where's this player come from? He's genuinely the best player Manchester City have at the moment. And I'd say the impact he's had as, look, I know it's a team game, but he's so quick to move the ball these days, and he's so quick at getting forward into and exploiting the space, which is something that you know, when you're watching City play a side like Wolves or West Brom, for example, at the Etihad, and that, you know, they've got 10 men behind the ball and it's just slow and you know, really turgid football side to side, and there's just no sort of movement to get to break through those lines. Gundogan's doing that. He's getting forward. He's finding these clever pockets of space, which is enabling other players to, you know, defenders to come out to him and to create that space behind, which is having a massive impact. And he's always had that little run into the box, you know, that late run into the box to be the third man in there. He's always had that in his locker. And now he's, you know, he's reaping the rewards as well as the other hard work that he's putting in going forward.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
We can't not talk about Phil Foden, John. It was an outstanding performance from him. A lot's been made of his finish, and it was a cracking finish. We can't take that away from him. But I want to big up the role he played in. Was it the second goal when Alisson gave it to him and he beat about four men to get to the byline?
Yeah, you know, it was he sort of drifted past Henderson with speed, but some strength as well. And you know, I'm sure people have got their own opinions about Jordan Henderson. He was Player of the Year last year, and I'm not sure he's the best player in England, but he's certainly a strong, experienced, good midfielder. And Foden just brushed him aside. You know, that's nothing to do with being a centre back. That's just, you know, that could happen in the middle of the pitch. Yeah. He's been beaten by a skillful player. And yeah, it was. I think it was a landmark performance. He's really, really announced himself that, you know, that was a big game. It was, you know, Liverpool had to win that to get themselves back in the title race. And I think the best player on the pitch, or the most effective player on the pitch, was Phil Foden. So you're talking about 22 of the best players in England. And Foden, for me, was the best one out there and the most made the biggest impact. So, you know, everyone wants him to do well. I think everyone, when he does good things, they get picked out more than anything. But, you know, there's no doubt now that he belongs with all those top players now.
Yeah,
at City and Liverpool.
Sam, that finish, though, for the final goal of the game, it reminded me, you know, of all those times that you used to get the ball onto your left foot at Mellon Sports Centre, take a step round the defender that was in front of you and whack it as hard as you can and get it stuck in the beams on the roof. Except it went into the goal.
Bring that up again. yeah, you know what? Phil Foden at the minute, I know the past couple of years, we've all wanted him to play a lot more. Been critical of Pep for not playing him enough, but clearly, you know, Pep's had a plan for him and it's worked really well, and we're seeing the rewards of that. And what's really pleasing is when you see Phil Foden's performance at Liverpool, and you can tell it really means a lot to him. It's just so nice, and it's great watching a young footballer play out his dream. You know, he's clearly loves playing for Manchester City, loves getting the ball in big games, loves making things happen. And he's playing the way every single one of us watching the football match would love to play. Yeah. And that's the best thing about it for me.
I'm glad you said would love to play, because I thought you were going to say would play. And I was like, you've seen me play well, you know, you've seen me
not
play
anymore.
Well, mate. And
maybe a few years ago.
Not a chance I could put anything like that together. Let's finish talking about penalties. John, Guardiola was asked last year who the best penalty taker was at the club. He said it was Edison. He was asked again after the Liverpool game whether Edison would be taking penalties because Gundogan missed. This is what he said.
When I commented this 6 months ago, it was a joke. Now it's a half joke. I would consider it is a, will not be a joke and it will be a taker. So, yeah, we don't have a real specialist in this area. So in this kind of games and no kind of stages, miss a penalty, punish you a lot. Fortunately, today we can turn over, but yeah, we'll have to talk about that issue, because I am still thinking that Kevin is a fantastic taker and Gundo is a fantastic taker too. What I want is the guy who takes the personality, I'm going to take a penalty, I'm going to score a goal. This is what I want.
Please support the show by becoming a backer. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
If that's the personality he wants, John, then he's got to look at the goalkeeper, hasn't he? Surely.
But if Edison misses, where did they go from after that?
He sprints back as fast as he can, yeah.
I mean, it's not the dumb thing, is it? That's the thing, but I think we'd all love to see it, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I definitely would. The thing is, though, Sam, like you can understand, can't you, that it looks like you're taking the piss, doesn't it, if your goalkeeper runs up to take a penalty. But like City's penalty problems are so well documented now, then surely it's quite easy to say, well, actually, look, everybody else keeps missing, so like it's his turn.
Yeah, well, look, the fact that we're even talking about Edison, the goalkeeper, taking a penalty really speaks volumes about how much of an issue this is for City, and it shouldn't be. You know, it's 12 yards. It's these are professional footballers. I know that's really cliche, that argument, etc., but it does baffle me. And I think Pep makes a great point there. When you look at the personality of a player and you look at some, you can tell they're going to score it, or you can tell they're going to miss it when they step up to take a penalty, I think. Great example, Mario Balotelli. Best penalty taker we've probably had at Manchester City for a long time. Did he miss one? I don't think
no,
he did.
Never
did
missed one for City.
But he always looked like he was going to score. He had that confidence. He had that arrogance. He'd toy with goalkeepers. Do we have anybody at the minute who's got the balls to do that? Edison. that's why we're saying it, you know, because someone with that, you know, that just oozes confidence, and it it's, I think, you know, we're touching in, or I'm going into the realms of psychology, you know, when it's striker against goalkeeper, it is a psychological battle as well as, look, it's just the ball on the spot, 12 yards out, get it on target, you're probably going to score. So we're making it more of a psychological thing. But the only reason we're doing that is because of City's poor penalty record. And again, it's consistency. So we've seen De Bruyne miss them, Sterling's missed them, Mahrez has missed them.
Jesus, Gundogan, Aguero,
yeah,
all missed.
Jesus, Gundogan, Aguero, yeah, all missed. So until we have, you know, I think he seems to have a lot of faith in Kevin De Bruyne, which rightly so. It sounds like he is the penalty taker, and when he's on the pitch, he's got to keep taking them. If he misses one, I think he still should take them, because it's all about building confidence, and you do that with consistency on penalties.
The thing is, when can Edison take one? If it's 0-0 against Spurs,
pre-season friendly.
what I'm saying is, at the moment, if it's 0-0 against Spurs, you can't risk Edison, because if he misses it and he's left out a goal, you're in trouble. If it's 3-0, then you give it to someone else, Gundogan, someone to just get a little bit of confidence back, because it kind of doesn't matter if you miss. I don't see where Edison takes this penalty now.
Yeah.
So
the only way I could see it ever happening is if we find ourselves in a number of penalty shootouts and he takes like the fifth one or something.
Oh, I think he'll take one in a shootout. I think he'll take one.
I think he's got to justify, like, it's got to be in the top corner, absolute thunder bastard of a penalty, everyone. And I think, unless we see that like three or four times, then, but realistically, it's that.
Joe Hart took an absolute belter of a penalty, didn't he?
Quick word on Salah, John, because you poked a bit of fun at him a bit earlier on. You can understand why fans are annoyed, but he was fouled, wasn't he?
Well, the thing I always look at when I'm watching these back is what is exactly what we're suggesting has happened, and the suggestion from that is that Diaz has tugged him to the right, pulled him back, and he's fallen to the left with his head. So, you know, this is sort of cause and effect, isn't it? And so that's the issue. He was fouled. But I'm not sure. It's not caused him to fall over in that way. That's the problem I have with it.
No, he's been fouled, but he's dived as well.
I don't know. It goes back to this. You know, what do we constitute as a foul? Outside the area, etc. But I just think if that was a City player, I'd be embarrassed. If that was an England player in the Euros, I'd be embarrassed. But you know, I can understand why Salah and other players do that in the penalty area when they do get a contact on them, because, you know, chances are it's going to be given as a penalty, and, you know, you want to give your team every advantage possible of winning a match, and if it means you know, going down whenever there's any form of contact, then they've got to do it, haven't they? But it's just frustrating, because there's so much at the minute around VAR.
Well, there's no way the VAR overturns that, because the foul was there.
I don't know. Go on. Why do you think it's a foul?
Well, he's pulled him back. You know, you can't pull players back when they're the wrong side of you.
Has he, though? Has he? For me, it looks like he has a touch on his arm. It doesn't like he's pulling him in any. You know, it's all down to, you know, it's a physical game. Like,
that's what I'm saying. He's not actually in the process of pulling him back. He's not actually pulled him back, has he?
He's not impeded him, is what you're saying.
Well, he's not. You know, his body is not moved towards the direction he's being pulled. It's moved in the opposite direction. He's not being impeded. Mm. It's an attempt at a foul, but he's not actually being fouled.
He sort of he steps off, doesn't he, Diaz? As soon as he knows what's happening, you can sort of see it in his eyes, on the slow motion. You can see the moment where he goes, "Oh shit, this is Salah. I better get off him." But it's by that point, it's too late. So it's frustrating, and it's frustrating as well, because, you know, he'd have probably scored, Salah. So why do that? Why have to go to those levels, those extremes? But again, like I said, you know, if it gives your team an advantage of winning the game, then of course players are going to do it.
I didn't think it was the worst. It wasn't the worst penalty I've seen. It was understandable.
Yeah. Right, well, City's success this season has been built on defending well, apart from that penalty incident. Back in 2007, when the club wasn't able to boast the star names and firepower it has now, it was their defensive record under Stuart Pearce that kept them in the Premier League, boring to watch as it might have been. In the January of his final season, Pearce brought in Michael Ball to give him more options at the back. I've been speaking to the former left-back about the move to Eastlands.
Unfortunately, at PSV, the change of managers, I wasn't really in and around the squad anymore, so I was looking for game time and to obviously get back playing football again. And there was a few clubs were showing interest to my agent, and it was only when Stuart Pearce made the call to my agent to say, you know, we're ready to take him, get him some game time the rest of the season. And you know, I jumped at the chance then to get back home to the UK and basically to get back playing and show everyone what I was capable of.
Yeah, what was that City team like when you were coming in? Did you know much about what City's struggles had been scoring goals that season?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, obviously, my good friend and everyone was Richard Dunn, so we always kept in contact. And when City showed interest, I gave him a text and said, I'm jumping on the plane and I'll see you in the morning. He was like, why, what's happening? So it was good to obviously get back in the changing room with Richard. And obviously, he's been a key player for City. So obviously, I've been looking at City's results for many years while Richard's been there and hoping he does well. And to be a part of it was great. Met Stuart Pearce in the training ground, did me medical. He took me straight to the first team dressing room and he just said, this is yours now. Go and prove to everyone, you know, why I brought you here. I'm not allowed to be in here anymore. You know, I used to be a player. And then I was a player manager, but the lads have barred me from the changing room. This is your sanctuary. Get to know the players. And I'll see you on the training field. So it was as quick as that, really. Which was good, because all you want to do as a player is just get back on the training field with lads, show your hunger and desire that you want to be, you know, part of the battle, because they were going through, you know, difficult times. And I've been on the other side of the fence where, you know, you just want new faces to come in to freshen things up in training with different ideas and different experience, and hopefully that's what I brought.
Yeah. As the weeks went by, I mentioned the lack of goals that City were scoring that season. As the weeks went by and the goals weren't coming, as part of a defence in that kind of situation, did you feel more pressure on in that situation just because of, like, knowing if you concede a goal that the team is in trouble at that point?
Not really, not off the top of my memory. In my second game, I played sort of wing back when I first came in. The way we were set up very sort of defensively with three at the back and two wing backs either side. So, you know, defensive side we were okay. I was obviously trying to implement going forward and create more chances for our strikers. And the first game was sort of thick and fast for us. And then the second game was at the FA Cup game against Preston. And that's when I got the goal. And then Stuart Pearce, you know, come over, give me, put arm around my shoulder, went, well done, go and get another one. And I was thinking, you haven't seen my goal scoring record in the past. So, you know, yeah, it was good. You know, obviously he knew they were struggling for goals and he was asking for the fullback to get on the goal sheet again was quite surprising, but it was just sort of wanting me to implement my game and be more forward thinking. You know, I was a defensive minded player, so I think his comments were basically saying, you know, go up and support the forward players as much as possible because we're comfortable at the back.
Yeah, I you mentioned the goal at Preston. I was in the away end that day, and where I was stood was right behind where you hit it. So we had pretty much the same view of that flying into the top corner. What do you remember of it?
Yeah, it was just the build-up play was pretty good, and Gavardi, when he hit the bar at the post, you know, I was sort of ball watching, really thinking it was going in, and when the ball, you know, came sort of bouncing, you know, towards myself, my only thought process was to keep the ball down and just get a sweet strike on it as much as possible. And you know, it always looks better when it goes in off the post, doesn't it? So it was, you know, the first I thought I missed, but I've been unlucky in the past with other clubs hitting bars and posts and just always nearly being there. So it was great to see it sort of hit both posts and go in.
Yeah, when it got towards the end of the season, obviously there was the Manchester derby there. There was obviously the incident with Ronaldo early on as well. What was going through your mind when that happened?
Yeah, that's something I'm like... I don't really know, you know. I had apologised after. I don't really understand. You know, I've never been sent off in my career at all, and And I just remember speaking to my father beforehand. I played against Cristiano a few times at Rangers in the Champions League, and you know, I've always thought I'd done well against them. I always backed myself against anybody, no matter who they were, that I could always sort of make it difficult for them. And I just knew the way it sort of happened. You know, Cristiano was sort of the boo boy of English football, you know, in that summer. And then he turned it all around by his performances for United and, you know, the type of player he was. He's, everyone's opinion was like, you know, what a player this guy is. And I didn't get the opportunity to play the first time, but the second time round I was involved, and I just wanted to make him aware that, look, he's going to have a difficult game against me. You know, if he wants to play well against me, he had to play to his best, and that's what I was trying to do. And I thought, if I get an opportunity in the first few minutes, I'm going to, you know, not sort of stick one on him, but just sort of let him know moments that I'm going to be there for the full game. And for something I can't really explain what went over me. Obviously, seeing him on the floor and the incident happened, you know, I've never done it on a football pitch before. I don't know what come over me to do it. And that sort of just, you know, sort of set the tone for the whole game, really. That sort of spared Ronaldo on to prove, you know, he could get up and carry on playing the way he can do. And we just had the battle then from that moment. So it was something I'm, you know, obviously embarrassed about. It was an incident that, you know, yes, you can put good tackles in, but I've always been a good, fair, strong tackler. That was sort of a slight dig, and something, you know, I was ashamed of really, and I can't really explain why or the reasons why I did it.
Yeah, obviously that was Stuart Pearce's final season as manager. What was the next summer like? Because obviously the club was going through the takeover, then Sven-Göran Eriksson arrived. It was all kind of like a whirlwind in a couple of months, wasn't it?
It was. For myself personally, I didn't really understand my situation. My move from PSV to City was it was a loan. But then I was sort of free and available. We knew there was going to be changes. I went to start a pre-season with City, and Sven coming pretty, you know, I think we were training with sort of an alter manager for the first few days. Sven came in, spoke to the players, spoke of his desire of where they want to be, how they're going to achieve it, the owner's new belief, and we're thinking, okay, this sounds interesting. But then personally, my circumstances, I was thinking, I might not be here. The manager's going to get a pot of gold to go and bring in his new players. And Mike's saying was, well, I might not be here. You know, Sven did say, look, you know what, you're all good players, but I'm going to bring more players to the football club to make us successful and start challenging for titles. If you want to be a part of it, you know, get out the training field and the games, you're going to get an opportunity. Show me. If you don't, I'll help you move on. So there was obviously a few players went up for the challenge, and you know, for their personal reason, for myself, I was just thinking, right, okay, I'll have to prove to the manager that I'm worth keeping. He brought in, was it nine players? I think it was 7 to 9 players, I think, within like a week or so. And there was a left back there, so I was thinking, well, here we go. You know, I spoke to Sven, and he goes, well, you're going to get your opportunity. Everyone's going to get their opportunity. The goalkeeper's situation at the time, you know, there was Casper, Joe Hart, and Alex. They're all going to get their fair crack of the whip, and it's no different for the outfield players. So if you do a job, you stay in the team, but you just got to keep yourself fit and available for when that opportunity comes, and show me that you're willing. So that's all I needed to know. As long as I was getting a fair crack of the whip, he was happy to keep me for the year. He goes, look, let's see what you can do. And then we'll reassess it in the summer. So I was happy with that. I was happy with the battle. And I think every player, you know, especially now in modern day football, but even back then, you'd love competition because it thrives you each and every day to go to training to prove that you want to be the number one in that position. And it hits, you know, it sets the tone in training and the levels, the standard in training, you know, from even that short period of time, the levels just went up and up with the players we were bringing in.
All of our City interviews on our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
And part two of that interview with Michael Ball will be on next week's show. I'd like to welcome Jack from Rule the Roost podcast. We're going to talk about Spurs now. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Dave. How are you doing, mate?
Not too bad, thanks. So what's going on at Spurs right now? Last time you were on the show, we were talking about a potential Spurs title challenge, or at least I was. Since then, you've won 16 points, while City have won 38. There's been a major difference.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to be a kind of classic problem for Spurs. In a lot of it's about mentality, I'd say. I think you can pinpoint several instances of where we've kind of shown a bit of, should we say, mental fragility, I'd say, in the wake of disappointing moments in matches or games. But a lot of it as well is probably just we're seeing individual errors are costly, and it's kind of what you get as a result of not really investing in a squad in a proper way, as we have done for so many windows, you know, or haven't done, I should say.
Yeah, I was going to say, you sound quite tired of it all.
A little bit, mate. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is, you know. It's exacerbated by the Mourinho factor, I would say, but I'd be being disingenuous if I felt he was completely to blame for all of it. He's just probably the worst person to have in charge at one of these moments when you're already feeling a bit downbeat about your club.
Yeah. John, the thing is, City playing Spurs, whatever happens, in the last 18 months or so, whatever happens when City meets Spurs, weird things happen, don't they?
Yeah, I think probably the first thing that comes to mind is Aymeric Laporte making two mistakes in that Champions League game when he hadn't made a single one all season. And the other thing, obviously, Mourinho gets slightly under Pep's skin. It's not quite as bad as it was when they were both in Spain, but Mourinho's won the last two games against Pep. So, it'd be interesting to see what his approach is when it comes to the Etihad, whether it's this open game that we saw in the FA Cup this week or the more Mourinho style we used to, back to the wall and letting City attack. Because if he does approach it that way, this might not be an unusual game. It might not be the surprise that we expect from Spurs, because the way City are playing at the moment, you know, they are unstoppable. And even a packed defence trained and marshalled by Mourinho in midweek won't be enough to stop them, I wouldn't have thought.
The thing is, though, Jack, that's an approach that has worked well for you in the last few games. I mean, the last few games, it's let City have the ball and we'll hit you on the counter-attack.
Yeah, and I mean, I just agree with the point that was raised there, though, in the respect that we've seen the last time Tottenham were playing expansively. I think the last time we saw that notably was the West Ham 3-3 earlier on in the season. We'd come off the back of sort of smashing United. We were flying, go 3-0 up, concede three in the dying stages of a game, mostly down to individual errors. And then from that point on, Mourinho went full Mourinho again. Park the bus, whatever you want to call it. And what we're seeing now, though, is that doesn't even work, because as tired legs kick in, as just the season goes on, the actual just lack of quality in our defence is coming to the fore. And I agree that we're kind of damned if we do, damned if we don't in this one. Down the years, we've seen, yeah, OK, Spurs can spring a surprise against City, but equally, there are just those games, you know, need I mention Edin Dzeko at White Hart Lane, where City just turn up and they just know they're the better team. And I think this is going to be one of those. And it's not even self-preservation, just we're not in a place to match you at the moment.
Sam, when you hear that, like that coming from a Spurs fan right now, and the fact that, you know, that 2-0 defeat at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium was City's last defeat, and it's all the way back in November, you must feel confident about this game, even though knowing, like John said, strange things can happen against Spurs.
Yeah, strange things can happen, and it's a little bit frustrating, City's recent record against Spurs, because it's really quite predictable. You know, the way the games have panned out, particularly with Mourinho, you know, he's really tried to strangle the sort of game, if you like, in the midfield. And you know, City's form at the minute is unbelievable. And I think, you know, they'll go into this game thinking, look, you know, it's just another 90 minutes. Let's get the 3 points, and on rolls the machine. That's how things should be. But we all know Mourinho in these sort of sorts of matches knows how to sort of really frustrate Manchester City and Pep Guardiola's sort of style of play. And I think looking at Spurs' team, you know, with Ndombele and Højbjerg in the middle coming into to form, particularly Ndombele, the way he's turned things around, you know, they could really strangle, you know, the likes of Ilkay Gundogan, who's been, you know, unbelievable at the minute. You know, they're going to be putting a target on his back, certainly. And I think there's areas in the middle of the pitch where Mourinho will be looking at how he can get to City. And I think it's just a way of Manchester City being able to, you know, bring their other players into the game that maybe haven't necessarily had the headlines like Gundogan has. So I'm talking like Mahrez. Obviously, we know how impactful Phil Foden was at Liverpool. I think it's going to be more about those players rather than the midfield for City.
Yeah, John, when the name that Sam didn't mention there was Sergio Aguero, how close is he to fitness?
Well, the thing with Sergio is that he seems to lose fitness. When he loses his fitness, he seems to lose it a bit more drastically than everybody else. So I think Pep's been extra cautious with him, particularly after the way he came back early in the season and then quickly went off again with a hamstring injury. So as of before the Swansea game, he had a small amount of training with the first team. Obviously, that'll be stepping up, but he certainly won't start against Spurs. And I wouldn't expect to see him on the bench. So I think he'll be a little bit longer yet.
Yeah. In terms of influential strikers, Jack, how's Kane and Son getting on? Because those two traditionally cause City problems.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing we got going for us, right? They're a force of nature at the moment. Son has been patchy, as he often is, but he's still always a danger. Yeah, if we are to get anything from this at all, it's going to be through them. I think there's a ridiculous statistic at the moment that there's been no other team in Premier League history other than Sunderland on Quinn and Phillips who have been as reliant on two players for goals as Spurs are this season. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see us maybe go 1-0 up, get a bit excited, and then reality comes back to bite us.
Yeah. In terms of City's attacking threat, though, Jack, the one thing that we were talking about penalties earlier in the show, the one thing that you might be wise to do is if City get clean through, just chop them down. Just chop them down. They can't put it in the net from 12 yards.
I was thinking that Gundogan, he doesn't have the best record with penalties, does he?
He should do. He normally does. And then he missed one against you. Was it last season? And then that's it. From there on, he just thought, oh, maybe not. And then against an Anfield, just skied it.
So he is human after all, then?
Yes, he is.
There you go.
Right, so Jack, let's have a prediction for the game. We've got a charity back coming up later on.
I hate to say it. You know I'm not just going to do this on a silly one. I predicted us to win last time, but this time I can't see anything past probably a big, and I mean a big win for City. I think it's going to be like a 4-1 job.
I hope you're right. We'll check the odds for that a bit later on. But for now, Jack from Rule the Roost, thank you very much.
Cheers, lads. Have a good one.
That brings us to the midweek game with Everton on Wednesday. We're joined now by David Downey from the Blue Room podcast. David, it's been an interesting season for Everton. We might actually get to play this game this time.
I was going to say, haven't we been here before? Haven't we done all this before? but very different circumstances for both teams now, isn't it? It's actually an interesting contrast if you to compare this time to last time when the fixture was meant to be held, isn't it? Particularly with you guys, obviously the 15-game winning streak doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. And I think we've actually sort of maintained the decent form we had going into it as well. So it's an interesting one. I'm not sure if I feel more confident or less confident, to be honest.
I don't think it really suits either of us for it to have been. Like we both said at the time that we thought it might have suited us to be moved from when it was. Mm. And now I don't think we both want to play each other at this point either. It's a bit daft, isn't it? How did Everton benefit from their 2-week break, as Klopp put it?
Well, yeah, I think we could do a whole different show on that particular subject and that particular man, couldn't we, and what he has to say about these things. But not good, to be honest. In hindsight, I think now I'd rather have played it because I think we went on a loss to West Ham 1-0 at Goodison, which, I mean, I'm ecstatic about how we've done this season and how well it looks like we're going to be doing, given this newfound belief and the momentum that we've picked up with recent results. But that particular week, I mean, I thought it'd do us the world of good, because if you remember, it was 2 days removed from when we just had a hellacious trip to Sheffield United. And by that, I mean the weather was absolutely disgraceful. And we managed to gut out a 1-0 win there at Bramall Lane. And then everybody just looked like they were on the backsides when that one finished. Players just ran into the ground, and you were sort of praying for some sort of intervention from somewhere, and we obviously got it. And I thought that'll be the real kickstarter we need. No other clubs are getting this sort of break at this time of year. We should really be able to kick on and get some players back fit for when we took on West Ham at home. And then invariably, in typical Everton style, we went and lost that 1-1-0 and look as jaded as if we'd have carried on playing after the Sheffield United game. So, yeah, it's sort of it's funny how these things play out, isn't it? And now, of course, it's been moved to, again, not an ideal time because we have a Merseyside derby 3 days later.
Yeah, John, we were talking before about the potential impact of that injury to Rodri. We don't know the extent of it yet, but I mean that's going to be a key area for these two games against Spurs and Everton, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly with unsure exactly when Fernandinho is coming back. So obviously, I mean, I think Rodri in particular has really grown this season. You know, I think everyone was a little bit unsure whether he would be a direct he could be a direct replacement for Fernandinho in his first season, but he's. He's really learnt the job now, I think, under Pep. What it is he's required to do in terms of keeping that back door closed and keeping City dominating possession in the opponent's half, and an absolute key figure. He's stepped up that sort of pace of his passing and things like that, shifting the ball from side to side, which is so important for City when they're trying to prize open defensive sides. So, I mean, the other knock-on effect is that you may be looking at Gundogan as the guy who drops back a little bit further, and then City lose something with him not being further up the pitch. Obviously, yeah. He's been so effective recently.
Yeah, Sam, we were talking as well at the start of the show about City's game in hand. This is it. It's. Do you feel they need to press home the advantage that they've built up over the last few weeks in these two games?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, they've been on a 15-game unbeaten run. And it just wouldn't make sense for them to not continue that pace and that momentum and that ruthless streak in games. I think this Everton game is going to be really interesting because you know, the Everton have had a couple of really good results recently. Obviously, they've got a lot of spirit in the camp. We saw you know, we all enjoyed that that comeback at Old Trafford that they managed to do in the last minute. And I think what was really impressive about that is, look, the way they started that second half. You know, they scored two quick goals and it looked like they really meant business. So I think it should be a really interesting game, and it's certainly not a gimme.
Yeah, David, I mean, like Sam says, the comeback at Old Trafford, not only that, but it's been, okay, it was an exhausting 120 minutes against Spurs, I guess, on Wednesday night, but like you did come out of it on the right side of the result, which always helps.
Massively so, and I think, you know, when I apologise for that, I've got two Dachshunds there who are barking away in the background.
It's all right.
They agree with you.
Yeah. I think they're angry at the fact we've got a Merseyside derby 3 days later, which will undoubtedly puncture our season. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think those 120-minute games, and you guys will know this, having played plenty of extra time games in years gone by, they're only, it's sort of like on a knife edge how these things end up working out sort of short term in what follows. And I think if you invest that much time and effort into a game and don't win it, then it's an absolute killer. For us to go through and sort of in a very un-Everton-like way in recent years. I've written about this recently, actually. It feels very different under Carlo Ancelotti, simply because these are games in years gone by that we'd lose comfortably. Going 2-0 down at Old Trafford, we'd lose or invariably try and have a damage limitation sort of idea into the second half in games like that. Whereas this now, even though it's not ideal in terms of the fitness and the sort of fatigue issues that you have and the obvious connotations of taking a game into the latter stages like that, this side seems to not be just deterred by things like that. And all of a sudden, what I was saying to you before about the time and the cancellation of the first game between City and Everton, now we're all looking at it thinking, bring it on. You know, you want to play again really, really quickly because you've got that feel-good factor amongst the players.
Yeah, how's Goodison Park been for you recently?
Well, do you know what? I was looking, doing some stats on this when we went 1-0 down against Spurs and we've been poor. I actually think there's more of an issue to it than many other people are making of it because three games we've lost recently over the winter, Leeds, West Ham and Newcastle. Newcastle have done the double over us, but at Goodison, we seem a little bit clueless, whereas when we travel, there seems to be an idea that everybody's on board with and are happy to go along with. Whereas at Goodison, it fluctuates in terms of what people think they should be doing. Should Everton be taking the initiative in games? And obviously, invariably, you'd say yeah about that in normal times when there's fans there. But I sort of prefer it now when we've got away games. I think we're unbeaten in 8 on the road. And I prefer it. And it sounds crazy and it'll sound bizarre to you guys given your record at the Etihad. But I'd rather this was there, to be honest with you, rather than at Goodison, because it feels as if there's a pressure. I'm not sure what from within or whether there's an idea that the fans would still expect us to do this, so we have to do it, but it feels like we have to be on the front foot, and I don't think Everton play their best football when they're on the front foot. I'm happy for us to concede possession and find a different way of going about getting points from games.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't fancy if City have to get something on that last day of the season. I'm not 100% about that yet.
You'll have it going up by then, mate. Don't worry about
that. How's Calvert-Lewin? Because obviously he limped out on Wednesday.
Yeah, I think as of now, I haven't checked in the last hour or so, but we're still waiting results of a scan that he's having. It looked precautionary more than anything else. It looked like a bit of a tweak, but Duncan Ferguson did the post-match instead of Carlo Ancelotti last night, and he was saying that it looked a little bit dicey in terms of his prospects for the next couple of games. So, I mean, that's a killer for us as well. And obviously, we've just signed Josh King, who didn't even get on the bench against Spurs. So there might be a little bit of a crisis up front for this game. You're looking at Richarlison probably playing a lead role in attack, or as we did at Leeds, I think he put Sigurdsson as like a false nine, which actually worked really well in the end. So, yeah, there's an issue there. But, yeah, I think we simply have to have Calvert-Lewin if you've got a chance of getting anything out of this game.
Yeah, right. Well, it's predictions time. Adam Carter was spot on with his prediction of 3-1 at Swansea, so that's taken the total for this season's charity bet up to £590. The money is going to the Christie in Manchester, which treats cancer patients from all over the Northwest. William Hill is giving each of us a £10 correct score single. We're going to start with the guests. So our Spurs guest, Jack, earlier on predicted 4-1 to City in this game at the weekend, which is 16-1 and £160 if you're right. David, what are you having for the Everton game?
See, this is the fear of like Jack's prediction there. You know, it's you don't often see that from opposition fans. There's usually some sort of robustness, isn't there? Yeah, I think I'm raising the white flag as well myself, as good as we've been doing. I think City will win 3-1 at Goodison.
That's 10-1 and £100 if you're right. John, give us your Spurs prediction. What are you having?
I'm going 2-0 against Spurs for a City win.
11-2 and £55. And while you're at it, what are you going for Goodison?
I think it's going to be even tighter than that. I think it'd be 2-1 to City.
13-2 and £65 if you're right. Sam, what's your Spurs prediction?
I'm going for City to be ruthless against a side that are struggling at the minute. And I'm going to go for 3-0. I'm going to put the sword to Spurs. Finally.
Finally. That's 7-1 and £70. And for Everton?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, City are on this unbelievable streak. I think if Diaz is playing, they look really solid. And like David said, you know, questions over Calvert-Lewin. Going to go for 2-0 City.
That's 6-1 and £60 if you're right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more information on responsible gambling, have a look at begambleaware.org. David, thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem at all, guys. Thanks very much for having me again.
Okay, so time to move on. And we're going to hear from Howard Hocking. He's talking about the development of Phil Foden at City.
As Phil, foot-like attraction engine Foden, put the cherry on the icing on the cake during Sunday's match to end City's Anfield hoodoo, and I made a similar groaning noise to Gary Neville as Jamie Carragher went very quiet once more, as he tends to do when Liverpool are losing. I began to think about Stockport's greatest exports since Fred Perry, Michelle Keegan and the Hart Museum in more detail than I had ever done before. People talked about that goal being symbolic of him coming of age, but as any City fan knows, he's been coming of age on a near weekly basis for quite a while now. Safe to say, he has arrived. Arrived, popped his coat on the peg, made himself comfortable and got his own groove on the couch. He's part of the City furniture now, part of the first team, still in the infancy of what I hope is the longest of careers. What it got me thinking about, though, was what it meant for a local lad to break through into this stellar team. Because fact is, I'm rather spoiled nowadays, like a lot of us. I expect success, and if success comes, I don't really give too much thought about the nationality of who provides it. After all, I've fallen in love, quite literally, with plenty of players over the past decade who have come from foreign shores. David Silva did not grow up in Beswick, and it doesn't matter to me. If my team is winning leagues and cups, it has never really concerned me if the team is full of Englishmen, Mancunians or Spaniards. See, I've been singly obsessed with the results over the past decade, perhaps because the media coverage following the vast investment in the team and the club has compelled the team to win things. Even as a fan, I have felt that pressure to succeed. For some City fans, the need for local talent will matter more than to others. We all see things in a unique manner, after all. But even for me, the breakthrough of Phil Foden represents something special. Let's think about why. But first, Phil Foden succeeding at City poses quite the problem for rival fans. The angle this time was clear, and has been since Foden was old enough to buy a drink or invite girls back to hotel rooms, that City, and specifically Pep Guardiola, were ruining his career by not playing him enough. This is a trope that's been running for years, which is quite remarkable considering he's still only 20 years old, with over 100 appearances. No other manager has attracted such relentless criticism and questioning over playing time for a teenager, but like no other manager is Pep Guardiola at Manchester City. Across the city, they have played a youth player every game since 1749, don't you know? So, with regular appearances, Pep has taken away even that opportunity to belittle one aspect of Manchester City, as it slowly dawns on all that Pep has handled him brilliantly and will only make him an even better footballer than he may otherwise have been. He's nurtured him like I nurture the first pint of the weekend, by which I mean with great care and affection, with the anticipation of what is to come. Hopefully there's no hangover with Phil's recent performances, however. The other problem for those that would rather Phil Foden did not become a generational footballer at Manchester City is the fact that he is a lifelong City fan, and this is one of the key advantages to having the local lad break through. Even when I was speculating if he should get more games, and we've all done it at some point or other, I never for one moment worried that he would leave City. This is no Jadon Sancho situation, a player who we ourselves nicked off Watford before he was nicked off us. He was hardly likely to ask to leave, and no one at the club would even dare sell him. The recent murmurings of him not being happy with his playing time didn't really concern me much either. And naturally, this is not something you can say with any non-City supporting player. Now, players like David Silva and Sergio Aguero stunned me into silence by staying as long as they did, or still are. I assumed that 3 years of Manchester weather would have been enough for them to endure, if that, and they would go back to warmer climes with my full blessing. And yet they didn't. And yet there is still that little part of me after watching rain bounce off my window for the 27th successive day that wonders if some of the City players who have headed north to put on the shirt are thinking about whether life has more to offer than a soggy elderly edge. So when Phil Foden breaks through, the local lad who probably trains in short sleeves in February, I can dismiss such worries. Now, the only way he would leave City is if the club decided to sell him, but that would take a bizarre and frankly unlikely set of circumstances. Any circumstances that would seem leave without fans rioting in the streets, the most fertile mind would struggle to imagine. Unless his form somehow falls off a cliff, Phil Foden should be at Manchester City Football Club for the next 15 years. If he does not fall foul of bad injuries, he could break a lot of records. But surely the most important point to make about a local City supporter breaking through and capturing our imaginations of that and that of the footballing public across the country is that it stirs the soul like nothing else can. It shows that even if you are not a Liverpool fan, it can mean more. To see the kid that was a mascot and a ball boy at the club scoring the fourth goal at Anfield is hard to contextualise in words. It's a special moment. To hear global press salivate over a guy born a few miles away and to see what scoring and winning means to him is the closest we as fans will get to having the joy of fandom replicated on the actual pitch. He represents us in a way, as who of us have not dreamt about doing something similar to what he did on Sunday? And we must thank Pep for ignoring the clamour and forging his own path for Phil. When you buy a player for big money, that transfer fee puts great weight on their shoulders to succeed. In a way, someone who comes through the youth ranks escapes such pressure because there's no fee. But instead, Phil Foden has his own unique pressure to deal with, as he has been singled out with good reason as a breakthrough star for a number of years now, our greatest youth hope for a generation, and he's not shown any signs of struggling with that pressure. It makes his performances all the more remarkable. Just keep him off penalty duties and I'm sure he will continue to develop and flourish. And so I'll finish with a quote from his manager.
He has to be calm to understand the tough periods is going to come. And it depends on his humble, because it is, because the expectations at that age, we'll see if can handle it. So now the people expect every game to do exceptional things. This is the most difficult thing.
Indeed, Pep. But as I said, he shows no signs of stuttering in his development. He will at some point. Young players almost always stumble at some point. In fact, all players do, whatever their age. But even a year ago, I could not have conceived just how special a talent City had on their hands. It really is a wonderful experience to witness his many comings of age. And long may it continue.
Hi, I'm Fabian Delph, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Howard Hawking. We're going to finish with Ask the Panel, as we usually do, sending you questions for next week on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email us through the website, bluemoonpodcast.com, and check us out on Instagram as well. Just search for Blue Moon Podcast on there. First question this week comes from Anthony Abdul on Twitter. He asks, did you think that the move into a post-Silva and soon-to-be post-Sergio era would happen quite so quickly and convincingly? If Pep were to leave after 2 years, an incoming manager would have the ideal blueprint of a competitive side. It feels like a huge achievement to me, one of his greatest. John, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think that's a good point by Anthony. It is a huge achievement to replace David Silva, because he was such a pivotal player for a decade. But it wasn't quite overnight. It was a bit of a slow changing of the guard, because he was in and out of side for two seasons, and perhaps in those big games towards, you know, in his final year, he was missing out on those ones, which, you know, having said that, City weren't successful. But yeah, he did look like a big, big shoes to fill, and particularly it looked like Phil Foden would be the one. And yeah, he's played more of a winger as we've seen, and it's players like Gundogan and Bernardo Silva which have really sort of stepped up into that position. And you know, David was such an intelligent player, and you can't really teach people to be that, just natural understanding. You just have an instinct for that. And you know, Gundogan has got that, but I think he's played down his impact recently and saying he's been playing well ever since he's been at the club, which is true, but I think he's really stepped it up with a bit of confidence on the back of it, and that's why he's been so effective. So, yeah, I think that's a really good point from Anthony.
The interesting one, Sam, is the soon-to-be post-Sergio era, because I feel like that's the transfer City have to get right, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly. And likewise with, you know, the post-David Silva era, you know, you're not going to replace a player that's had such an impact at the club like those two have had. But what you can do is get a great player in place that fits the system that Pep has built. And I think that's the secret to how sort of seamless this post-David Silva era feels. You know, it's not that, you know, great, you know, we've replaced David Silva, if you like. It's that another great player has come in and fit the system really well. You know, the system that City have is built for players to be able to come in and to know off the, you know, like the back of the hand. And I think that's really the best thing about what Pep Guardiola's done at Manchester City is really build this fluid system that suits all of the players, really. And I think we've seen that with, obviously, losing a player like David Silva. I think, you know, if David Silva left when Pellegrini was in charge, I think it'd be a totally different scenario at the moment. And I think with Aguero, look, you know, you could argue that, well, we're already very much in that post Aguero era.
Barely played, has he?
He's barely played. When he does play, you know, he gets injured again. It's really it's difficult to see as a fan and as someone who loves Aguero and obviously the impact he's had for the club. I think we're very much in that era anyway. Who comes in?
We all want Haaland, don't we? That's the thing.
Well, I think in the transfer market, the club will be going out to look for players that can not just be an out-and-out striker, but fit the system. If the checkbook was open for anybody in world football and you're asking me who do I think would fit the system really well, I think Mbappe would be top of the list for me. You know, he can play through the middle, he can play out wide, he's quick. Likewise with Haaland as well, though. But, you know, I don't make these decisions at Manchester City, so thankfully.
We're going to come on to that now, John, because Noah Lawson on the emails asks, there have been reports that City have been interested in Danny Ings, Romelu Lukaku and Erling Haaland. Who would be the better option for City? And do you think Gabriel Jesus could replace Sergio Aguero?
Yeah, I think, although, like Sam was saying, we are almost in a post-Aguero era, I think they've got to get this one right. I think perhaps lessons need to be learned from the way that City didn't replace Vincent Kompany and paid a bit of a price. You know, he was such a legend of the club, and it's taken them 18 months to find Ruben Diaz, and I don't think they want to make that same... You know, they want to get in at one of those strikers straight away. But having said that, you know, they are coping well. I mean, obviously they're absolutely flying at the moment, and Jesus is not going to be a direct replacement for Sergio Aguero. He's, in some ways, he's got more to his game because he can play in different positions. He can be effective from out wide. He runs harder. He pressurizes, and he's in some ways more of a Pep player than Sergio is. But obviously, what he hasn't got, which Sergio is brilliant at, is just unbelievable goal scorer. The greatest goal scorer of the last decade, maybe, I don't know, maybe the Premier League's best striker of this century. It's going to be very difficult to replace, but of those three that have been linked, I think, yeah, Haaland would stand out as age-wise, potential, and also what he's done so far. You know, he's quick, he's a goal scorer, he's powerful, in many ways looks like the perfect striker.
And Sam, crucially, the son of a former City player, bring him home is what I say.
Yeah, certainly. Really surprised that he's linked with Manchester United, you know, given those connections as well. but yeah, look, it is, we could have this option, this option, this option. And I think John makes a great point. The club have got to learn from 18 months without Vincent Kompany, not quite getting it right. It has to be right. But then saying that, you know, we haven't had Aguero for some time now in his pomp. So, you know, can we afford to be a little bit further down the line with Gabriel Jesus?
Don't take that risk.
Yeah, but it's not as easy, is it, as saying, right, let's get Haaland in and he's going to bang 30 goals. You know, there's never any guarantee, I suppose. I think as well, the club, from the recent sort of transfer record with Manchester City, I think they're very sort of risk averse at the moment. And that makes total sense as well, you know, given the current situation around the world. I think teams are going to be a lot more risk averse in the transfer market. So I think are they going to spend over 100 million getting Haaland and Mbappe? I'd be surprised.
There might be another name, another Argentinian to replace him who could score a few goals.
Go on.
Well, Mr. Messi, who knows what's going to happen with him at the end of the season.
Yeah, that is a very, very good point indeed. And we're going to leave it there. That's it for this week's Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you to my guests, Goals.com's Jonathan Smith.
Cheers.
And my good friend, Sam Roscoe.
Thanks for mate.
Please go and give the podcast a rating and a review in all the usual places. It means other City fans can find us as well. If you'd like to support the show a bit further, or you'd like to listen to the podcast ad-free, then you can sign up to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and all three tiers are now displayed in your local currency. None of that having to convert from US dollars nonsense all the time. All three tiers are the same, and you'll get ad-free shows, plus the weekly bonus show too. This week we're discussing the common players between City and Everton. All the details are on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. facebook.com/Blue Moon Podcast. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.